Welcome to Dialogue on Teaching, Wabash Center's podcast series. I am Nancy Lynn Westfield, director of the Wabash Center. Paul Utterback is our sound engineer. It is my great pleasure to welcome to the conversation today Dr. Sarah Farmer. Dr. Farmer is associate director of the Wabash Center for Teaching and Learning in Theology and Religion. Thank you, Sarah, who's on my staff, for being in the conversation. So I know you as a marvelous teacher and an exceptional researcher. That's why we hired you, right? As we scan the country. So in your world of teaching and knowing how to teach and pedagogy and being a scholar of pedagogy, why research or why look at confinement? Why incarceration?
It's interesting. I think initially it wasn't really about me looking at incarceration as it was as much about me looking at hope. And I think, hope has been a theme throughout my life. And so when I was teaching in the prison for the first time, I think when I started, it really started around some of the assignments around art, where there seemed to be some momentum that was different from some of the other assignments we were giving in that space. I really started to think differently about hope and the ways in which just women have something to teach us. Like, I was in the prison teaching the women, but I'm like, you know, women who have to navigate such a dehumanizing context, I actually have something to learn about hope from them. And so that's actually what kind of got me started thinking about the intersection of incarceration and hope.
So at the intersection of incarceration and hope, you were so deeply moved and created a research project that you wrote a book entitled Restorative Hope, Creating Pathways of Connection in Women's Prisons. And that book is just out, Restorative Hope. Tell us about the book.
Well, the book is really, so when I started the question, I wasn't just asking about kind of how do you define hope or what does hope mean for you, but I was really interested in exploring what does hope do for you? How does hope function in your life? And then using those insights to think about, so what does that mean for teaching and learning, you know, when we're in those spaces? And so the book really is kind of interviewing, doing focus groups with women primarily who are formerly incarcerated. So I use that as a source, but also just the time teaching in the prison. And I asked the question kind of what nurtures and sustains hope in a dehumanizing context. And in the book, I explore three different categories, and which won't really surprise anyone, because I feel like the three categories is really what it means to be human. It's about what it means to be human. But the first category is around connection. Women are able to nurture and sustain hope when they can connect. And that connection is multifaceted. The connection is a connection to self. It's a connection to others. It's a connection to a higher power. And it's institutional connections, which is super, super important. The second thing we looked at that came about was resilience. And so the ways in which I think, you know, it's some mystery around how someone gets resilience or where does it start? But resilience, being able to navigate that context. And I looked at three different ways in which I saw women being able to navigate that context in a way that nurtured and sustained hope. And those three ways is creative, the creativity in this space, what I call dogged resilience. And that's the kind of resilience we often think about, right? Where, to be honest, it's like women are kind of, it's like a Herculean task to do some of the things that women are required to do to be seen as a productive citizen in society. And it's almost not fair, but dogged resilience. And then the third is what I'm calling embodied resilience, which is really what it means to survive, orientation towards survival. And then the last thing is identity, the ways in which women kind of re-narrate their identity in that space in order to nurture and sustain hope. And then the
talking
last,
about, go
no,
ahead.
I was going to say, and then the last chapter, we're looking at theological education, the implications for theological education.
So you talked about the notion of identity paralysis. Tell us about identity paralysis, which is such a strong term.
So one of the things that for me that really became clear, and it wasn't clear before being in the prison context, but just the ways in which hope really is about movement. Oftentimes when women talked about like seem to have despair or a sense of hopelessness, it's because there was a sense of stuckness. They were stuck in something. And in particular, when I'm talking about identity paralysis, sometimes women become so stuck in either what has been imposed upon them, their criminal, and I'm using quotes, their criminal identity, the thing that they have done in the past, that it begins to define them, either internally, so how they see themselves, but also externally, how people foreclose opportunity and possibility for them so that they kind of get stuck in an identity where they can no longer become. And so even just this ideal around being and becoming, like that movement and how important that movement is, becomes really kind of key when I'm thinking about identity formation and reformation. And so identity paralysis is when the possibility of being and becoming gets foreclosed because people get stuck in an identity that is not their own.
So I don't want to trivialize the despair and the journey of incarcerated women, but so much of what you write about in the book becomes metaphorical for those of us out on the outside in different kinds of prisons, right? So when I was reading your book, I was both thinking about and empathizing with the women on the inside, which is with not a metaphor, right? When you are incarcerated, there's nothing metaphorical about that, right? And so much of what people describe in organizations living the quote American dream, which you mentioned in the book, and being dissatisfied with living the American dream, are experiences of a kind of being in a cell, being alone, being incarcerated, being imprisoned. Did you find yourself, or do you still find yourself after the book working with the notions that you're working with metaphorically?
I mean, I think definitely. I mean, one of the main things I think I realized from the book, and I have a tendency to do this. I'm more optimistic, but just what the prison being in that space is hope is not sanitized, and so and hope is not a luxury. And so one of the experiences, I'm going to talk about the experience in the prison and try to bring it out. But one of the experiences in a prison, I was teaching a course called Perspectives on Hope. And during this time, one of the women who I also taught, but that had really gained notoriety in the prison, had really changed her life, was about to be executed. And so during this time when I'm teaching Perspectives on Hope, several women dropped the class because during that time there was two kind of stays, like that there was a possibility she wouldn't be executed, but then it would go be back on, then it would stay, and they just could not handle the roller coaster. And I had another woman that dropped the course because of her health condition and everything else going on. And so I think just this sense of hope, sometimes we can kind of like you're a bad person if you can't find hope, right? But I think being in that kind of environment also helped me to know how much of a roller coaster hope is, and that it takes courage to hope, particularly in the midst of the up and downs of life that is in everybody's life. Sickness, death, all these things, just being a Black woman in society, in a racist, classist, sexist society, has its own kind of way in which you have to like navigate toward wholeness. And so when I think about these three things, connection, identity, and resilience, I think that it's the thing that will continue to nurture and sustain hope whether you're in the prison or whether you're just trying to kind of live life outside the four walls.
So I do pedagogies of resilience. You and I have talked about that. And we have a common mentor, Ann Wimberly. Ann Wimberly is, I'm going to say, the guru of hope. And yes. I used to say, Ann, Dr. Wimberly. Like, I was not a hopeful person. I did not write hope into my own pedagogy. I do not write hope into my theology. I did not. Until I started having conversations with Dr. Wimberly, right? So why hope? You know what I mean? Like, you could have called this other things. You could have pursued other things. Or you could have also taken the three contributories that you mentioned and not come up with hope. But the fact that your umbrella concept is hope, why that? Because I'm saying that because Dolores Williams busted me and said, in resilience, there is no resilience the way you're describing it. For Black women, there's only survival. Mm-hmm. And I've been thinking about that for 25 years. So in your discussion, in your book, you mm-hmm. take similar concepts that we're all wrestling with and you come up with hope. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying that's wrong. I'm saying mm-hmm. why? Like, why hope?
I think hope is an orientation toward life, whether that's survival, whether that's, you know, I think it's a continuum, right? But I think survival is the bare minimum of hope because it is toward life. And for me, it's impossible to live without some form of hope or some form, some orientation toward life, some orientation toward breath. And what I talk about as embodied resilience, that is kind of what I'm describing as the bare minimum. The fact that someone is alive and there's breath in their body is life. And for me, that's still an orientation toward that to me, that is hope. To see breath, to see someone living and moving despite the odds, for me is a way to kind of still lean in toward flourishing, lean in toward, like, I want to live, I want to continue to exist.
So there's possibility.
Possibility.
Right? You're saying where right. there's life, there's possibility.
Exactly.
Right? There's still something for the spirit to visit. There's still something exactly. for the blood to surge through. There's still something exactly. to be helped.
Exactly. Right?
You can give assistance if there is life.
Exactly.
If there is death, you can't give assistance.
And I also want to say, when I'm talking about hope, I'm not talking it as a privatized notion that hope is kind of to yourself, is solitary, is what you do internally. But part of what I'm trying to say is that hope is public and that it requires assistance from other people. This is why connection is so important. Or, you know, all the various ways of connection, that there are some things that can't move forward without someone from the outside kind of giving assistance to. And that's for right all of us. So even the people that talk about making it by the bootstraps, no, let's be honest. There were things you had some legs up, you know, but there were people that kind of were in that journey with you. And so that's part of also kind of my reimagining of what hope is that it's not privatized, but it's public. It requires a response, a call and a response.
So Sarah, who's the book for? Restorative Hope, Creating Pathways of Connection in Women's Prisons. Who's the audience? Who do you hope reads the book and even talks to you about the book?
I think I would love for theological educators that's just thinking about the concept of hope and the way it shows up in their work, in their research, but also in the lives of their students. But also for those who are really interested in learning that takes place in other places outside of the formal classroom. So prison is one site. So there's a whole movement of higher education in prison. I would love a conversation with those scholars, but also just conversation with scholars who are rethinking where education can take place. Sometimes the most formative education is not in the classroom, but is in other sites of learning. And so I'm really interested in those who are doing community-based learning or are just rethinking and reimagining where theological education, who the students are, you know, of theological education.
So Sarah, thank you so much for this critical conversation. All right, we're looking forward to Wabash sponsoring at AARSBL a panel on prison education and education with incarcerated persons. But we're also looking forward to just your voice in theological education as we reimagine, reconstruct, reconceive, right? It takes the creatives and the artists, for me at this point, to see what the next steps, the next visions might be. And you're a part of that leadership team. So thank you.
Thank you.
To our listeners, the Wabash Center website is the place. Look on our website for details about our hybrid workshops, resources on teaching and the teaching life, as well as our re-granting program. A special thanks to podcast producer Rachel Mills. And know that the music which frames the podcast is the original composition of Paul Myrie. Wabash Center for more than 29 years is exclusively funded by Lilly Endowment Incorporated. And we are out. How was that, Paul?